Welcome to the GoTo Podcast. Each episode covers the brightest and boldest ideas from the world's leading experts in software development. Tune in for practical lessons, compelling theories, and plenty of inspiration. GoTo gathers the brightest minds in the software community to help developers tackle projects today, plan for tomorrow, and create a better future. Stay up to date with the latest in tech through GoTo's top-rated events held online and in person in cities like Amsterdam, London, Copenhagen, and Chicago, and by subscribing to the GoTo Conferences YouTube channel, where you can find thousands more high-quality dev talks. Learn more at gotopia.tech.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of GoTo Unscripted. We're in Copenhagen at GoTo Copenhagen 2023. I'm Andrea. I'm from Italy. I'm a member of the Elixir team. Elixir is a functional language that runs on the Erlang virtual machine. And I'm here with Francesco.
So I'm Francesco. I'm founder and technical director at Erlang Solutions, O'Reilly Offer. Been working with the Erlang ecosystem since the mid-90s. Yeah, very fortunate to have seen a programming language become an ecosystem of languages. And I think it's probably what we're going to talk about today, right?
I think so, yeah. So Francesco and I live very close to each other. We've never met in Italy, only through conferences, various conferences. He's been involved with Erlang a lot longer than I have. I came into the Elixir generation. So how was it to see this ecosystem grow, or like this small language, I guess?
It was really interesting. I mean, the first language on the beam came about. I discovered it had been written. It was called Rea by Tony Arcieri, and I heard about it at OSCON, the Open Source Conference in Portland, in 2008. Mm. And so when we ran our first conference in America, we invited Tony to come in and present it. Mm-hmm. It was really, really interesting looking at how, you know, he'd taken a Ruby-like syntax and then applied it to Erlang, running on the Beam, which is, the prevalent virtual machine on which, we run everything today. And then from there, soon after, Lisp-flavored Erlang came about with Robert Verdi, mm-hmm. FN, by Mariano Guerra. And so, there were a lot of Prolog, got ported. So there were a lot of languages which came about, but, and some even being used in production. But we never kind of realized it had become an ecosystem of languages, and probably until 2014, when we were in San Francisco, and we had, for the first time at the Erlang factory, dedicated a whole track to Elixir.
Mm-hmm.
It was still in the early days. I think it was the year the first Elixir Conf happened. So I think something like 140 people, including Dave Thomas's dog. And I was walking with Garrett Smith, and we were discussing this new phenomenon called Elixir, and really excited about what was happening and how Elixir was opening up the door to whole new communities of programmers. And in that conversation, it kind of transpired, Gary came up, Erlang's becoming now an ecosystem of languages, mm-hmm. And that's when it clicked. Yeah, well, that's exactly what happened with Java. That's exactly what happened with .NET. Mm-hmm. And the same was happening with Erlang. And it's been amazing to see, and then, and you look at it today, I think there are over 35 languages running on the Beam, which is really, really impressive. Mm-hmm. Not all obviously are used in production. Many are experimental.
You do?
But
and it's interesting. I was speaking with Sam Aaron from SonicPy earlier.
Yeah.
And he was talking about the differences between Java and Clojure being a lot more mm-hmm. than the differences between, for example, Erlang and Elixir. And I think that's... do you feel that's true, that like in the languages on the Beam are much, well, there are many flavors of languages on the Beam, and well, some are statically typed, some are like have different flavored syntaxes like Lisp, or they look like Prolog, they look like Lisp, or they look sort of like Ruby. Do you feel like the difference, my feeling is that the differences are like
I agree. They're not, the differences aren't major, but that's, in my view, is that Erlang, they got a lot of things right when they invented Erlang, when they created Erlang. They spent probably 3 years prototyping a certain domain of problem, problem domain of scalable, fault tolerant soft real time systems. First looking at all existing languages, industrial languages being used in the industry back in the '80s, and then from there using a virtual machine implemented in Prolog. So by the time they started creating the first virtual machine written in C, they'd come so far in this prototyping activities that they'd really streamlined and created a language with the bare bones and bare necessities. If you ask the different co-inventors of Erlang what they contributed, Mike Williams once told me, I spent most of my time convincing Joe and Robert that even though this was a really cool language feature, we didn't really need it because it didn't add any value. And these design and prototype activities, they looked at different constructs which they tested, and if this construct added value and reduced the code base, then made the task of building these telecom systems easier, they kept it. If it didn't, they removed it. And so as a result, I think Erlang became a very compact language, which was fit for purpose. And so as a result, I think all of the languages written on top of the Beam, get all of those features and then add their own flavors to it. Accidentally, look at the T-shirt I got. I put on today. Which flavor?
Of Erlang is your favorite? Then this is very small. I was wondering though. Do you think that these similarities between these languages are also due, that's also how I feel in part, but also due to the fact that Erlang is really hard to extend. Like, it's not like the basic data structures in Erlang, for example, are very set. Like, it's just those. And if you look at things like, for example, queues in Erlang, they're implemented as like on top of existing data structures, tuples and lists, right? Or if you look at structs in Elixir, they have to be implemented on top of maps. They're like something that compile time checked, but they have to be implemented on top of maps. Do you think that's...
I mean, everything is possible, even with Erlang. But, when people go out, when language inventors go out and create a programming language, they're out to solve a particular problem. And I think, so the problems they're trying to solve dictates, the features which they need. I mean, if you look at macros, for example, they exist in Erlang, but they're very well hidden and they're not accessible to everyone. So they're very hard to use and implement. And that was a conscious decision because they didn't want the language to be extendable. I think one of the problems they were trying to solve was the cost of maintenance. They were trying to reduce maintenance and operational costs in systems, which they did very, very successfully with the toolings and the hooks, introspection hooks you've got into the VM. But everything we were being able to, all the systems we'd be able to solve, with. It's rare we've gone in and said, we wish we had this or that. Maybe libraries might have been missing, but not really language features, because keeping it simple meant you could do things with a few lines of code on top of it if you need it. And that,
A super interesting thing that comes to mind is that maps, for example, are really recent language feature, right? And they now feel like a really necessary language feature. Right?
Absolutely. I mean, maps were first presented, I believe, at the Erlang User Conference by Richard O'Keefe, and what eventually became Maps in 2000, but it probably took a decade before they made it into the language.
Yeah.
And
because I remember it was around the time Elixir was becoming 1.0 that they actually made it to.
Correct, yeah.
OTPR, 17, maybe?
Correct, correct. And again, this is Ericsson, Ericsson... is a benevolent dictator, and that's the realities when you're dealing with open source. And they're incredibly conservative over new features because they add to the language, because if they add something, they need to support and maintain it. And
decades.
Yeah, and not only that, but everything they do needs to be backwards compatible.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are tens of millions of lines of code in production. You make something which isn't backwards compatible, you break the build, and upgrading will take, can take years.
Yeah.
You know, we've seen, you know, we've worked on projects where they forked the beam, and to get the code base back on the latest version of the beam, you know, 3-4 years later, in some cases, you know, took 6 to 12 months of work. And we've seen this on multiple occasions.
The thing I like, though, is that I have a wish list of things that would go into Erlang, obviously. I think maybe the biggest one would be structs, because the interoperability would be really nice. Like the
I think structs is exactly what is stopping the ease of calling Elixir libraries from Erlang.
Esoteric looking stuff to get them to work.
Exactly, and it is one of the gating issues. So, you know, there are conversations ongoing, and one of them is, you know, possibly, you know, to add structs to the language for you know, compatibility issues. I mean, going back, you know, to the very first Elixir conf, I remember, you know, Jose saying, "Oh, yeah, we've got a we've got access to all of the libraries, written, you know, in Erlang, you know, which is decades of work of open source, you know, libraries, which we can use from Elixir." And, you know, the opposite isn't, you know, you don't have the opposite from, from Erlang, and it's payback time. So yeah, adding structs would be, you know, that would be one of the huge benefits from it.
I think so, yeah. And there is such like a central, like Elixir seems to have developed around structs a lot, like it's very idiomatic. You see them all over the place, extremely idiomatic. And it would be really nice to see them in Erlang core, because you could probably significantly optimize tagging the struct, for example, because we have to use this little like underscore struct underscore atom key that takes memory in all the structs that we have in the system. And like, it would be nice to have it in the beam, because it would probably
absolutely.
So that's really interesting.
As a side note, you know, Robert Werding added structs to Lisp favored Erlang, which is one of the many languages. It's a Lisp implementation running on the beam, and so that now allows him to call all the Elixir libraries completely seamlessly.
I'm curious if Gleam has structs. Gleam is a statically typed language that's compiled via Rust, though. Like the Gleam compiler is written in Rust, and it generates Erlang bytecode or AST, I don't actually know. I wonder if it has tracks, and I wonder I would bet that it has like records. It would be interesting to know if they actually can get away with not having them tagged, because it's a statically typed language, so you can like probably do the checking.
It's a good point. I don't know now.
But one thing that I've noticed in Erlang that's very exciting is that I do feel like it can be hard to extend Erlang the VM itself, which is probably for the best, right? Like it's a very intricate VM with like lots of it's a big VM, right? It's a very smart VM, like with the scheduling and the process and the garbage collection. It has lots of features, and so it would be hard, I think, to make it extensible in any significant way when you go and touch the depth of the VM. But recently it's been like the releases of OTP have been really exciting. Like they've added a lot of stuff in the last 2 or 3 years. Like Just8M was there, aliases were there, which are like incredibly awesome. The being able to call gen servers, I think this is OTP 25 or 26, like very recent, like being able to do asynchronous calls to gen server and like then check for the response later. All this stuff is like getting into core, and that's awesome, because it allows us to build a lot of these like lower level abstractions.
That is correct. Yeah,
but I'm a big fan.
If you look at an actual beam itself, it's I think the biggest challenges in extending and adding things to it is ensuring they don't disrupt the soft real time properties of the scheduler, which is I think their biggest fear.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you mentioned this, because like one of the people that are familiar with the beam and Elixir probably know this, and Erlang and Elixir probably know this, but one of the only shared the functional data structure, like pure functional data structure lives in shared memories is binaries, right? Like bigger, binaries larger than 64 bytes. So they go into like a shared memory area so that you don't have to move them around processes. You just move references. And that's the only data structure that I know of that's completely shared across. Well, now they have atomics and counters, but...
ETS tables is another
right. Which
has destructive operations.
Right. Yeah. So So, but ETS table is sort of like a meant as a shared memory engine, right? But it's treated as an impure.
Yes,
you can actually modify it.
Correct. Right? Yeah.
And instead with binaries, it's not like that. You can't modify the binary. Yeah. And it's so interesting to me that even just binaries, which are very pragmatic to be in a like separate memory space after 64 bytes and all of that, they cause many problems because like it turns out that like a lot of memory leaks in Erlang applications are from parsers copying binaries all over, like taking big binaries and splitting
fragmentation
and like exactly and like creating copies of these like smaller binaries or having like memory leaks where you have a reference to a binary that you don't clear up or the process doesn't die or this or that, and then you have a memory leak because like the binary never gets garbage collected. And it's interesting because you really notice that like even one data structure that is built in still bubbles up to problems for users in some specific use cases because like it's hard to do this. Like the Beam has wonderful properties of software timing, per process garbage collection, and you know all this stuff, but they're hard to maintain. You know?
Yeah, you've answered your own question.
Yeah,
as to you know why you know I think Ericsson has to be very conservative.
Yeah.
In changes and addition. I mean, just a JIT compiler, which was at least 3-4 years in the making. Extensive research, but you know when that came out, it allowed WhatsApp to reduce its server needs by around 30%. You know, that was the head of WhatsApp went out and tweeted about it.
Yeah.
You know, thanking Ericsson for it. And that's, you know, that in turn, you know, translates to huge, you know, energy savings.
Of course,
which is something, you know, we're seeing.
Yeah. It's interesting that Elixir itself is not, it's now in a spot where we're not adding much to it either, right? Mm-hmm. I think arguably more stuff is coming up into Erlang in the past like couple of years maybe because Elixir's ecosystem is expanding incredibly, right? Like all the machine learning stuff is nuts, like the live view stuff is nuts, but
this is the positive, also a good part of it is also the positive influence Elixir is having back on Erlang.
Yeah, because people are realizing that a lot of things you actually have to solve them in Erlang. Like, for example, aliases,
processes,
counters, or atomics, all these new features that have been added, persistent term, those are like fantastic features that have been added in just the last couple or 2 or 3 years, in Erlang. And that you just cannot do them. Like something like persistent term, which is like this shared persistent storage that gets just copied to all processes, very, very fast to read, very painful to write. It's awesome, like for so many use cases, but you just can't do it in like you have to do it at the VM level, right? You can't
correct
it. So it's really awesome that these features are like popping up in Erlang because like we from Elixir we just get them free and from you know in Erlang you can just use them. So like they are really truly, and you can use them in Glim, you can use them like in all the right times. Yeah. Like that's the benefit obviously of adding features to Erlang. So
that's what amusing. If you say nothing's happening with Erlang, no. There's a lot of work happening. You know, Ericsson is doing an amazing job.
And
driving things forward, but it's not so much you know the language. It's the libraries where the effort is being put in and on the virtual machine.
Yes,
and,
I think that's tricky because like the work that the Erlang team is putting into Erlang is really low level.
Yeah,
like something like persistent grammar, something like atomic or counters. These are really low level stuff that usually you need. 99%, I think, of use cases are for like library authors
or
OTP.
Exactly, which
like
doesn't
for example, are mostly used for gen server calls and like they're used by OTP itself, right? So you don't really get to, and the the advancements and the news that are happening in Elixir are like they seem more exciting because they're like much easier. It's like there's a new machine learning library that lets you like pick up models from Hugging Face and run your own machine learning models. Like that's something I can touch very easily.
Yeah,
it can really get easily to users. Or live new features in Live View, they get right in the hands of users. And instead, the work that Erlang is doing is just as important and just as prolific. Right, like they're doing a lot of stuff. It's just that it's so within maybe the...
It's much more low level. It's a low level.
It's harder to get it to users, you know, like...
It's where you need to have full control over what's going on.
But it does have an impact. I mean, I've used for libraries, I've used counters, I've used atomics, I've used persistence, all the new features, like, then they've been awesome.
So. An amazing new feature, which I actually discovered reading the manual pages a couple of weeks ago, is the ability to do match specifications. So a match specification, for those of you who don't know, is a program which, you know, provides a set of, it's a term, which it consists of a set of variables, a set of logical operations you can do on these variables, and then a set of actions. And so it's a very simple program, has a very, very small subset of operations and actions you can take. And it was originally being used for tracing local and global function calls in runtime, you know, without having to trace compile the code. And you wanted to turn on or turn off the trace or trigger trace messages trigger trace messages when certain conditions were met. So, you know, only if, you know, the first argument, you know, to a local call was user Andrea, and you know, and the second argument was Atom call home, for example, you could, at that level of granularity, you could trigger a trace message if you knew, you know, that was, you know, that was where, you know, you need to go in and troubleshoot. And, you know, this has been extended to, you know, to message passing, to pattern matching. It's just been extended to a large variety of things. It also works on ETS tables. It has worked on ETS table for a while, but, you know, so basically, you know, the both the power of tracing of, you know, kind of sequential calls, you know, to a lot of other constructs where, again, you know, you receive a process receives a particular message, you trigger, you know, you start tracing, you know,
it's a very fast way of like matching on stuff and extracting information.
Exactly.
Which is why it's allowed in ETF tables.
Yeah, it's not for the faint of heart. Especially if you're doing it in a live system. But it's, you know, for these really kind of hard to reason and hard to figure out bugs, it's again, one of the points of Erlang was to reduce operational costs, and this is, you know, this, you know, really reduces the time it takes to troubleshoot systems. And find that needle in a haystack.
Yeah, I think Elixir is doing a really, I'm not involved with any of it, that's why I allow myself to say it, but it's doing an amazing job at doing something similar with compiler tracing and like code diagnostics. There has been a ton of work really in the last, I don't know, year to like improve Elixir's Lexer and Parser and like all the code the compilers.
So you're putting hooks into the code basically
everywhere. So essentially, like the language servers become very precise in doing, you know, in doing stuff. Like now Elixir is able to partially tokenize strings that are like all Elixir code that are. That have syntax errors, so that like we can point you to the syntax error and where it is, you know, like all these tools, and that's really like, it makes me think of that, because like that's like really precise tracing at the compilation level, right? And like I'm not involved with any of it, sadly, but I will benefit from it. It's, you know,
it reminds me of when they went in and added line numbers in error messages, you know, which
Yeah, Elixir is able to, especially with this tooling stuff, is able to, having its own compiler written mostly in Elixir, right? And a little bit of Erlang, like the compiler for Elixir itself is very high level, but very easy to, I've always like felt it's like quite easy to contribute to, so it's quite easy to like do bigger stuff compared to language like where you have lower level compiler that like has to take care of like optimizations and like do multiple more passes. Like Elixir's compilation passes less, for example, right? So you have easier opportunities for, you know, doing this sort of stuff like tracing compilation hooks and all this stuff for code diagnostics. So for very interesting.
What did you tell us? You know, Elixir is making its way into a lot of new verticals. I think one of them is machine learning.
Yeah.
Can you share a little bit over what's happening in that space?
Yeah, I think I am not involved in that space at all, so you know, always a pinch of salt. But essentially, we have ported, like the Elixir, Sean Moriarty in particular has been leading all of this, but the Elixir community has been writing DSLs for Elixir that compile to this like GPU frameworks, you know, like I don't know any of them, like I'll embarrass myself, but essentially you can do tensor operations, you know, in Elixir now. Yeah. And from that sort of was born a whole ecosystem of things that you can do now in Elixir related to machine learning. The really interesting thing to me is that this is not, it's not necessarily better than Python, as far as I understand, for example, because they both compile to, like, you know, GPU instructions. Eventually they use like this Google compilers for GPU instructions and stuff. So it's not necessarily a better performance. But the thing that's been really interesting is this, it seems to be one of the first languages to actually challenge Python's dominance over this space, right?
It focuses on user experience,
exactly,
and adaptability.
It looks,
you know,
nice.
If they do for machine learning what they've done for web development in Phoenix, where they've really reduced the barrier to entry, where you need to know a little, just a subset of Elixir to be productive using Phoenix, you not understand anything of what's happening under the hood, and basically in no time you deploy a website. If they do the same for machine learning, I think it's going to really open up the doors.
There's a lot of focus. Absolutely. There's a lot of focus on user experience again, like we saw with Phoenix, like we saw with LiveView, like all these tools, like we saw with
Nerves as well.
Nerves, exactly. Yeah.
So Nerves is the embedded framework.
It's a framework. For like embedded devices, and like the same thing, like just very, very usable, very user friendly, and they're doing the same thing with machine learning. And to me, it's very interesting because like, you can see that the ergonomics make a big difference, right? Like having, even if like maybe performance not going to be better than Python because they're going to compile for like very similar. I don't know anything. I could be saying like total lies here, but like I think that's how it works. And, you know, it turns out that the ergonomics and developer experience and usability matter to developers, right? And I think it is like, it's interesting. This is one of the, from my very limited experience, it seems to be one of the very few languages that are actually challenging Python's, because Python is like, it's the thing in the machine learning sphere, right? Like that's, you write Python, and instead like Elixir is coming up with like, oh, hey, you know, you can actually write this in Elixir too. And it's very, very interesting to see what that will, you know, will bring in the future. I have no clue. I'm not involved, sadly, because I don't know. I don't really do anything with machine learning, but
what really kind of excites me is the ability to run everything in the same memory space. So, you know, if you look at Phoenix, you know, and you decide to use Mnesia as a backend database, you'd have the web server, you'd have your business logic and your database all in the same memory space, which, you know, make it extremely fast. I mean, it's faster to, you know, to create dynamic pages and, you know, to read static pages cached in Redis. If you can do the same, if the same happens with machine learning, then it's going to be fantastic.
Yeah, we use a lot of ETS at my job.
Yeah,
for caching and for like responding very quickly to requests, and you know, like we have an endpoint for beaconing BDS stats now that's like doing
ETS tables are the Redis so do we?
It's like half a millisecond, and it just queues requests, and then we flush them out to.
You want distributed ETS tables? Yeah, you just use Mnesia.
There's a lot of tools, very powerful tools.
I mean, just to wrap up, I mean, what's your view over kind of the future of Erlang, Elixir, Gleam, and the ecosystem as a whole?
Good question. I have no clue. My dream is just that like they become so interoperable that I can write some libraries in Elixir, some libraries in Gleam, some libraries in Erlang, and they just like all works together. That's my dream, because like I think people are gonna have preferences. Erlang is a simpler language, for example, and I think a bunch of, in that it has less features, strictly speaking, like there's less feature surface, but it's like simpler. Gleam has completely different characteristics, like, you know, the statically typed stuff. And I would like to be able to choose which one I want to use for different use cases. Like I want to write a compression algorithm. Like maybe Gleam is really nice because it lets me like do it, like have setting types to check all this stuff. I need to write something related to, I don't know, like mingling with, you know, protocol stuff. It's nice to have like the static types. I want to write something that like is going to be complex, and I want to write in Erlang to keep the feature set simple. I want to write something that's, you know, like uses protocols. I want to be able to use Elixir. So my dream would be to have, and also to have a single community. Like I wrote a bunch of drivers in Elixir for example, Cassandra, Redis, like all this stuff. I would love if people from a language just used.
Yeah.
Because like the
Katana. Absolutely, absolutely. Like, I think interoperability is key.
Yeah, I hope that.
I completely agree with you. And yeah, and from my point of view, I'm seeing kind of Erlang, Elixir, and other Beam languages making their way to edge networks and even out on IoT devices. And that's, for example, where I think, you know, Gleam would be, would really take off for the simple reason it's statically typed and it makes the language much more secure.
Yeah, you can take off a bunch of stuff.
Yeah,
you from runtime.
Exactly, you're actually reducing the the surface of attack and the external surface of attack. But the great thing is that all of these languages are interoperable and and dependent on each other. So. Hoping, they'll thrive and continue growing together. Thanks, Andrea.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the GoTo Podcast. Head over to gotopia.tech to discover lots more content from the brightest minds in software development.